This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The Asian American Pacific Islander community is reeling after 8 people were killed last week at 3 different spas in Atlanta, Georgia. With us today is Shruti Rana, the co-chair of the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, or NAPOF, Indiana chapter. Shruti, before we begin, how are you holding up right now, and what's the general feeling of the local AAPI community?
Well, first, thank you so much for inviting me to join, and also for asking about how the community is doing. I think people are really feeling a mixture of shock and horror at the devastating events, but also really coming together and reaching out to different community members, checking in on one another, and really building solidarity. And I think people are mourning and grieving, but ready to move forward and take action and try to prevent something like this from happening again.
Does the AAPI community feel supported or safe in Indiana?
I think that the AAPI community in Indiana, just like the community nationwide, has had a long history of facing these types of concerns. And I think people are not feeling safe. I think, you know, we all know about this recent spike in hate crimes, but this comes after years of hostility, discrimination, and other problems. And I think people are very wary. I think they're cautious. You never know, what could happen next. And I think people are looking at what happened in Atlanta and thinking those could be our mothers. Those could be our sisters, our friends. And I think people are very cautious. And this is not a time that people are feeling safe at all.
Well, Governor Eric Holcomb responded to a reporter's question during his weekly COVID-19 briefing when asked what his thoughts were on the shootings. Here's what he had to say last week.
Yeah, there's no place for it, not just in Indiana, but in the country. And fortunately, we have some legal recourse for those who have been wronged. And I'm glad that we have that in place. But again, this is not who we are. And it's up to each and every one of us to be a role model and to be able to, with open arms, say, welcome to Indiana, grow your family, grow your business, grow your lives here. We are a welcoming place. And so while I feel for any of those outliers or feel for those who have been wronged, and those cases that are outside of our borders, I should say, our duty is to make sure that every Hoosier feels safe, has the opportunity to do so, and that there is recourse if they are wronged, and we have that in place.
Shruti, what are your thoughts on what he said?
It's complicated. You know, on the one hand, I'm glad that the governor has spoken out against racism and wants to welcome different people to the Indiana community. But what we're really looking for is action and sort of community-wide support. And for example, the governor's statement specifically mentioned outliers and said there's recourse for people who have been wronged. But we all know that legal recourse is not available to everybody, right? Not everybody has access to lawyers and the courts, and not everybody is comfortable with policing and things like that. And not every act of hostility, racism, or discrimination is something that can be taken to the courts, right? We don't have causes of action for everything. And, the courts are really to be reserved for sort of the most egregious offenses or things that, courts are well equipped to address. What we're looking for is for the governor to take action. There's lots of things that the governor, as the chief executive of our state, could do. And what we're looking for is broad-based community support and measures. I think there's a need to, it's not enough to just say that Indiana welcomes people. It needs to be action as well as words. And I think, again, this isn't a matter of addressing a crime here or there or one act of violence here or there, but really creating an inclusive community that welcomes everyone and that shows, you know, where everyone is treated as a human being and everyone has the chance to really come here and make use of the opportunities that are here without fear.
You mentioned the use of the word outliers. We'll obviously have to follow up with the governor's office to figure out what that meant. But what did that mean to you when you heard that?
To me, it sounded as though he was looking at sort of the most horrific acts of violence as things that could be addressed. And, you know, those are things that can be addressed through the court system. But obviously, we want to look at preventing those things before they happen. But there are also a whole range of things that really affect people's day-to-day lives and impact the way that they are able to live, work, and, you know, contribute to our communities in the state of Indiana. So, for example, a recent report showed that, I believe it was nationwide, that one out of four Asian American children had faced bullying, you know, on the basis of race or ethnicity in this in their schools. So that's something, you know, children don't have the same access to the courts. That's not the type of thing that should be dealt with, you know, through the legal system. We really need to create an atmosphere where all children can go to school without fear and focus on learning and growing as people and not have to face things like that, right? And there's lots of things like hostility. There's many acts of racism. There's many things that people say that, again, are not addressed through the courts. And I'd also like to say that I'm also troubled by the use of the word outlier, because one point I want to make is that all the reports that we've seen of anti-Asian racism, hostility, and violence, particularly those, you know, there have been a number of incidents recorded by Stop AAPI Hate and other organizations. I just want to emphasize those are the tip of the iceberg. Not many, very many people at all come forward and report what is happening. And for example, almost every single member of the AAPI community that I have spoken to, you know, in my community has experienced some form of at least hostility during this pandemic period. And not one of those people reported it anywhere, right? I mean, it's just these things happen. They happen so often, in fact, that people don't report them because they think no one's going to do anything about them. And, you know, there's so much embedded, you know, misogyny, xenophobia, around that, you know, we need really broad-based action to address them and can't just focus on outliers. By the time you're looking at an outlier, it's too late, right? Somebody has already been hurt. Somebody might have already been killed. We really need to focus on prevention and inclusion in the first place.
If you have questions or comments for our show today or any of our guests, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Shruti, I know there were some efforts to send the governor a petition on behalf of the AAPI community. Can you tell us a little bit more about this petition and why it's important?
Yes. So this was something that we were working on before the incident in Atlanta, and we were working on it specifically in response to the spike in reported incidents of anti-Asian discrimination and hostility. And we created a petition asking the governor to take action to address these situations before it was too late. And we actually submitted the petition to the governor before the incidents in Atlanta. We've now reopened it for signatures. But what we were trying to do with the petition was to provide the governor with specific incidents that had happened in Indiana, let him know that this was a pattern and that this was escalating, and urging him to use his executive authority to take action. Again, there's many things that he could do. We asked him to take official action to recognize and condemn acts of racism and xenophobia and intolerance, implement procedures and processes to help the Asian American community members if they were targeted. We asked for the establishment of a statewide advisory committee or commission on Asian American Pacific Islanders affairs. These are all measures that there is tremendous amount of research supporting their effectiveness and how well they've worked in other states and at the local levels in Indiana as well. And we opened it up as a petition so that we could have various groups signal their support. And we have gotten widespread support throughout Indiana from a number of major groups, from universities to civil rights groups, to faith organizations, to community organizations. And what we were trying to do is say, look, there is a growing problem in Indiana that needs to be addressed. You as the governor have the ability and power to take quick, powerful action to address this before it's too late. And then, of course, what happened in Atlanta, you know, just really was everybody's worst fears realized. And it gave sort of an additional impetus, I think, to say, you know, look what could happen. We're giving you, suggestions for what concrete suggestions for what you could do. But also this is built on decades of research. And as well as we brought together, you know, community leaders from all over the state, people who are nationally recognized in these fields and have worked and thought really hard about suggestions or about solutions that really work. And so we are trying to bring this to the governor's attention. And we really hope that the governor will specifically address our petition and take action to address these concerns. And again, respectfully, I'm glad that the governor made a statement, but he's the one who has the power to take action that affects all Hoosiers and affects the state of Indiana and can make a tremendous amount of difference if he would take action.
Is there a deadline for when you're hoping to get a response from the governor? Or is this open-ended?
We had left it open-ended, and we will be reforwarding it again just to, you know, to let him know that, you know, in the wake of the Atlanta shootings, we've gotten so much additional support. There's just been an outpouring of support and attention. So I think probably a deadline is a good idea and something that we can implement going forward. But in the meantime, we've been reaching out through various angles. We've been working with community leaders and state legislators as well. For example, you might have seen that the Senate passed Resolution 29. Last week, condemning anti-Asian racism. So we've been building statewide and national coalitions, and again, have a tremendous amount of both expertise, but also direct connections to the people and small businesses and community members who are directly affected by what is happening here in Indiana.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Shruti Rana from Naphoff about the incidents that happened in Atlanta, the tragic incidents, the shootings there last week. And we'll be following up more on that conversation after a quick break. Later in the show, we'll talk about human trafficking across the state and the work being done to make sure survivors get the help they need. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back after a quick break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe.
Racism is real in America, and it has always been. Xenophobia is real in America, and always has been. Sexism, too. In the 1860s, as Chinese workers built the Transcontinental Railroad, there were laws on the books in America forbidding them from owning property. In the 1940s, as Japanese American soldiers defended our nation, more than 120,000 Japanese Americans were forced to live in internment camps, an obvious and absolute abuse of their civil and human rights.
That was Vice President Kamala Harris as she addressed the Atlanta shootings on Friday, along with President Joe Biden. As you just heard, she touched upon the history of racism in the U.S. and in particular how it's been targeted toward the AAPI community. With us is Shruti Rana, the co-chair of the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, or NAPOF, Indiana chapter. Shruti, there's been a lot of talk from various AAPI journalists and community members across the country and even here in Indiana that Vice President Harris's statements really made them feel seen. Is this the first time you've heard this much of a response from the White House on the topic of racism targeted toward the community?
Yes, definitely. It's the first time I've heard any statements of this type at the national level, and also so clearly and forcefully stated, and stated in a way to say, you are part of America. You are part of us. This is our history. This is our history of the United States, and we can't erase any part of it. And I think that's a tremendously powerful statement. And, you know, it's not an accident that it's coming from the highest Asian American leader who's ever, you know, who's reached the vice presidency in the United States.
And what was it like, I mean, hearing this from a female vice president, from a woman who herself has deep ties to the community?
I think it's a tremendously powerful statement that shows us how far we've come, but also how far we have to go, right? It's astonishing that it's 2021 and people don't know of the history of anti-Asian discrimination in the United States and how deeply embedded it is in our history. I think I constantly have to deal with people who are just astonished and surprised that there is even anti-Asian racism and hostility. They're just completely unaware of it, which which is a big source of the problem. And it's just so widespread. I wanted to add earlier that when NAPHOF, the national office, did a survey last month, they discovered that over the past 2 years, 50% of the people that they surveyed, of who were all Asian American women, had suffered some form of hostility, racism, or violence just in the last 2 years during the pandemic period. So I think people need to understand how widespread it is and how deep these problems go. You know, I mean, when we talk about history, I think often about the fact that when my father was born, he was barred from U.S. citizenship just by his race and ethnicity, right? His race and ethnicity alone meant that he was ineligible for American citizenship, right? He later was able to come to the United States and gain citizenship, but that was after the incredibly hard work of the civil rights movement and the tremendous solidarity with, you know, Black and brown civil rights leaders all over the United States. And I think that's a story that needs to be told. It's part of the American story. And it's part of the story of how we can make an inclusive society that really reflects the promise of our Constitution and our founding ideals. And again, I think this is a tremendously powerful statement by the vice president, not only for the words that she said and the level of inclusion that she provided, but because she has such a powerful platform, right? It comes across as a national statement with the support of our executive offices. And I'm proud and happy that she made that statement.
I want to talk a little bit more about what happened in Atlanta. I think one of the discussions that has come up is what constitutes the definition of a hate crime? Because right now we have two different things happening. We have a community that is mourning and dealing with the aftermath that see it a certain way. And then you have reporters who are covering this that really feel like they can't come out and say anything until officials acknowledge what they're labeling it as. So can you tell us, Rudy, what is the legal definition of a hate crime?
Sure. Hate crime definitions vary by state, but usually what they are, and I understand this is the case in Georgia, is that they offer sentencing enhancements, meaning a longer sentence for the perpetrator if they're shown to be a bias or motive related to one of the protected grounds. So it's important to recognize a couple of things that I think have been largely left out of the national narrative. One of which is that a hate crimes designation, again, is just a sentencing enhancement. If you, it adds a layer of complexity, and often prosecutors don't seek a hate crimes addition, because it's already difficult enough usually to prosecute crimes, and it's quite complicated. And so whether or not something meets the definition of a hate crime or a prosecutor chooses to pursue that doesn't mean it wasn't a crime motivated by bias, hate, or, a motive against a protected ground. And I think that the part of the tension that's arising is that I think the narratives around what's happening are quite misleading. I think if you look at what courts look at, the people targeted, they would look at who were the people targeted. 6 out of the 8 people who were killed were Asian American. The perpetrator targeted certain businesses, right? This is not a case where we're wondering whether there was an accident or whether it was a car accident or a deliberate act. We know it was a deliberate act. We know these businesses were targeted. And we know that even, you know, the perpetrator statements have revealed a lot of bias and misogyny. And so, you know, I think people look at this and they say, well, there's no question that there's a lot of biased motive and, you know, hate involved in this. And I think that's clear. And I think there's some misleading parts of the narrative. I think it was really sort of inappropriate for the police officer who came out and talked about the defendant's self-serving statements, basically saying that he wasn't motivated by racism. You know, I don't think a court would really give that statement very much weight. Again, it's a self-serving statement. We don't even know what he said. It was this officer who reported it, and that officer himself has a history of public and outward xenophobia, specifically directed at Asian Americans. So I think the discussion of whether it's a hate crime or not is a little bit of a red herring, right? We know that a community was targeted, that women, certain women were targeted, they were murdered. You know, the discussion of whether it meets the definition of hate crime or not doesn't affect the fact that a crime occurred, that specific people were targeted. This is part of a rising wave of anti-Asian violence. And there's a lot of evidence that the defendant was, operating in an environment of misogyny and xenophobia. And the big picture, looking at the big picture, there's no question that there's hate and bias involved. Whether the prosecutors choose to pursue an actual charge of a hate crime is a technical, judicial, and legal decision that doesn't impact, what the situation is, right? It doesn't impact what people are seeing and the impact that this has on people.
Mm-hmm. And what would you like to see? I mean, as we get close to wrapping up here, what would you think is the best way that people can move forward with situations like this? Do the courts need to change? If we're looking at Indiana, for example, do we need stronger laws in place? What's the best case scenario here?
So I think we need to start by listening to the people who are affected and listening to the communities and just acknowledge that they might be having these experiences that people haven't listened to before. We need to amplify voices. We need people to know what it's like to walk down the street and be afraid of, or going to the grocery store and being afraid that someone is going to target you. And also, again, we know that there are so many effective solutions out there and we need people to start doing them. It's not, we don't need to jump to immediately to start creating new crimes when we already have a legal system that could address these things, but doesn't, right? We know, again, people are afraid to report what happens to them, or they think if they report them, no one's going to take action. And sadly, that's usually true, right? Nothing happens. But also, nobody's using the existing tools that we have all that effectively. So why don't we start there? And then we can think about other things to do. I view the discussion about adding new criminal categories or something like that, again, as sort of missing the point. Because if you focus on adding something that isn't there and don't focus on the tools you already have, you're missing an important opportunity to take action and to address the situation right away. And again, that was why we circulated the petition, right? Saying here are some effective measures that have been shown by research and data to be effective. Some of them can be relatively easily implemented. Let's use the tools we have now. Let's listen to communities. Let's see what they are doing. Let's figure out what are the best ways to support our communities. What are the best ways to move forward and take action. And again, I think words are nice, but action is what makes the difference here. And I think there are just so many things that we could do that we could be doing. I think people are taking an important step right now in finally amplifying the experiences that people are having and finally making some of the links between racism, misogyny, sexism, and, the sort of history of the Asian American experience in the United States and drawing some of those connections. But we shouldn't have to do this only in response to a horrific event, right? We should understand, who is part of America and what these experiences are, and that we all have, we all have the rights to live here, to work here, to go to school here, and, that we all deserve equal opportunities in all of those areas. And we have those tools already. They just need to be used. And we just need leadership and our communities to take action.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of your insight. We really appreciate you coming on the program today. With us was Shruti Rana, the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum Indiana chapter, one of the leaders of that organization here in Indiana. And we'll be back with more after this. Can you tell if someone is the victim of human trafficking? How often does it happen, and how can we be more aware? That's what we're going to learn more about as we discuss the impact of this crime in Indiana and how big sporting events like March Madness can draw hundreds of people to the city, along with more cases of human trafficking. With us now is Kristen Hoffman, who is the directing attorney for the Workers' Rights and Protection Project at Indiana Legal Services. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you for having me.
Many people may think of Hollywood films when they hear the word human trafficking, something that's far off, something that couldn't possibly happen in Indiana. What are misconceptions around human trafficking that you've come across?
Miriam, thank you so much for asking this question. I run into people all the time who just refuse to accept that it's going on right in our communities in Indiana. A lot of people believe that trafficking either requires some kind of physical restraint, or that, like the media shows, trafficking involves the smuggling of individuals from one country into the next. In actuality, trafficking doesn't require the transportation of individuals at all. It is usually the provision or obtaining services from someone through force, fraud, or coercion. And trafficking is a huge industry in the world, that, you know, multi-million dollar, actually probably billion dollars. I think it's 60 million people are exploited for labor every year, and 24.9 million people in the world were subjected to forced labor. This is a statistics from the International Labor Office from 2017. But traffickers in this line of work don't have to use such overt ways to force people to do things. What we usually encounter are subtle ways that individuals feel coerced into doing something. And that could be the threatening to expose someone's immigration status, or telling someone that if they don't perform a sexual act, they're going to make sure that they don't see their kids again, or they're going to be reported to law enforcement for doing something illegal last week. So it's a lot more complicated and subtle than people really realize, and it's going on in a lot of different industries.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I've thought about human trafficking, sometimes I think of these posts that people will put online, like, oh, you know, watch your kids when you're in the store. If somebody's staring at them, they're going to try to take them and traffic them. You know, how common is that kind of a scenario?
Well, that really isn't trafficking. That might be kidnapping. But that really isn't a part of the discussion that we have with our clients. And Indiana Legal Services has one of the only trafficking related civil legal projects in the state. And we have several attorneys that are bilingual in English and Spanish that provide free legal services to trafficking survivors. And the types of cases that we see are either a variety of legal services for survivors of sex trafficking. They were trafficked by a family member for commercial sexual exploitation in order to provide basic needs for the family, or to support maybe a substance abuse disorder. We also have a lot of clients who are migrant or seasonal workers, and agriculture is a high risk industry for that. And Indiana has a sizable agriculture industry. A lot of the individuals that we're seeing are subjected to forced labor because they have a specific vulnerability or set of vulnerabilities that makes them feel they have to continue to work in an abusive situation. I can describe a situation where we represented 9 farm workers in a case, and we recently got a sizable judgment for them in the amount of $460,000. These individuals were all recruited from Mexico to come and work in the agriculture industry in Indiana. And they received promises of hourly wages, transportation, housing, and meals. And they came up to the United States. And once they got here, the housing was not as it appeared. They all took out some debt in order to get their visa and pay for the transportation to come to Indiana. And then a couple of weeks into the job here, they stopped getting any pay for their work. And their visas, when they come to the United States, prohibit them from changing jobs or from working for anyone outside of that particular visa sponsor. So in that particular situation, these workers were trapped. They had not been paid for over 6 weeks by the time they reached out for help, and they couldn't get home if they wanted to. They couldn't leave because they didn't have any money. They could barely scrape together money for food and necessities.
And, right, and so that, they were definitely being taken advantage of. And we'll come back and touch upon that after a quick break. I'm Miriam Soh. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soh. We're talking about human trafficking and what it looks like in Indiana. With us is Kristen Hoffman, who is the directing attorney for the Worker Rights and Protection Project at Indiana Legal Services. Before the break, we were talking about this case that you were able to settle for 9 farm workers who had been taken advantage of and been trafficked. Can you tell us a little bit more about when we think about Indiana and human trafficking? Many people may not realize that big sporting events are also something that can attract this kind of behavior to the state. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
I believe that large sporting events or any type of event that brings in temporary or guest workers, and you can see this with carnivals or with the Super Bowl or the Olympics, and the larger it is, the more prospect for profit there is, because there's a need for people to come in and perform services. So you can have an event like the Super Bowl drive up demand because there are additional purchasers for commercial sex. And what we know from working with sex workers here in Indiana is that very few of them are not survivors of human trafficking. They're in the line of work that they're doing because they were exploited by someone close to them earlier in their life. So you can also talk more about sex workers and the struggles they experience either with forced fraud or coercion or assault. But you definitely see an increase in demand for certain types of services. That would be one of them. We've heard about the massive amounts of money that goes into building a large stadium or preparing for something like the Olympics. You have a huge need for labor. It's temporary labor. You have contractors in place, and a lot of times you have low-wage workers coming to perform this work. So it's not uncommon to hear about how people undergo forced labor or experience labor trafficking in the preparation for hosting these types of events or building, constructing the land or the buildings that they'll be held in. But that's what we have seen in Indiana and has been reported on across the country and the world.
How do we spot these kinds of things? You know, if you're just out maybe at a sporting event or walking around your neighborhood, I mean, how would you be able to tell if someone is being trafficked and needs help?
I'm not sure it's something that you can actually just look at and say, oh, well, that, you know, that worker there looks like they might be subjected to forced labor. Our traffickers are very sophisticated in how they operate and how they keep individuals quiet. But what we do know is there are definite vulnerabilities with certain industries. So high-risk industries, agriculture, construction, domestic servitude. Sometimes you're never going to see workers that are being forced into labor because they're providing childcare for a family in a gated community. You're going to see increased trafficking in landscaping industries and carnival workers and hospitalities. And once you put in a temporary immigration status that ties someone to an employer, if there's any kind of labor exploitation going on at all, that individual is really susceptible to trafficking because they're so afraid to come forward and report the issue because of possible threats that they will be reported to immigration, or they're going to immediately be cut off from the only source of income that they have and their entire family is dependent on. But you also, mm-hmm. even where you don't have immigrant communities, you might have folks that are citizens of the United States that do not speak English, or they might be have an intellectual disability. And it's easy to see how people in different situations are made incredibly vulnerable to exploitation and forced labor.
Are you seeing any concern now with things like March Madness happening? Do you feel that you're ramping up efforts, or do you know of anything the government's doing to kind of keep an eye on the situation?
So we talked about this. So Indiana Legal Services participates heavily in our state's anti-trafficking task force, known as IPATH. It's Indiana Protection for Abused and Trafficked Humans. And in this task force, we meet and discuss various issues on human trafficking in Indiana with community service agencies, caseworkers, law enforcement. And as an organization, IPATH in the past has done outreach at large events. But the issue that outreach at a large event raises is, what happens if we do encounter survivors of trafficking at this event? The first thing that has to happen, and one of the most immediate needs that trafficking survivors have, is emergency housing. Most of the time, traffickers are in control of the housing, the food, the transportation for the victims. And if you are going to help someone get out of a situation, you immediately have to be able to find emergency housing and then later transitional housing. And what we know in Indiana is that there's a huge gap in available services for those two things. And so the real question is, how can we in good conscience go and try to help survivors if there is nowhere safely to go with them? So mm-hmm. right now, I firmly believe that we can do more as a state. There is no line item in the budget for trafficking work in Indiana. There is a line item in the budget for serving survivors of sexual assault. There is not one for serving survivors of human trafficking. And we have these real urgent or real immediate concerns and needs for emergency services for survivors. Because unless there are support systems and services available to help stabilize survivors, there is no incentive for them to leave their trafficker.
So do you think there's perhaps a lack of support? You mentioned there's no line item for survivors of human trafficking. I know that the 2020 Indiana State Report on Human Trafficking mentioned that the state doesn't have a centralized reporting mechanism. So there's really no way, it appears, to comprehensively contain all of the numbers or find out what's happening across the state. Could that be maybe part of the issue when you don't know the full scope because you don't have the data?
It is hard when you don't have the data. And in Indiana right now, there are a whole number of agencies that are funded in part to work with survivors. And it could be, in our case, it's federal funding and funding through the Indiana Criminal Justice Institute, which gets VOCA funding from the federal government. The issue is you don't have a consolidated data center. So Indiana can't tally exactly how many trafficking survivors are here in the state. And then they can't effectively chart the need for services for everyone. But I'm gonna go back to something that Shruti said earlier in the program is, you know, survivors often don't want to report. And in the case of survivors of assault or hate crimes, you have to have a faith in the criminal justice system, and you have to have the ability to come forward and report. And there's a lot of improvements that we need to make in the state of Indiana to make sure that human trafficking survivors do feel comfortable in coming forward to report. There needs to be a lot more trust built into the law enforcement system where trafficking survivors can come forward and not have fear of getting arrested. And actually, a lot of trafficking survivors do end up getting arrested. So it does not do anything to increase the data points that we would have in the state to have a better picture of what's going on here.
And is this on the rise in Indiana and across the country? Are we seeing more numbers of human trafficking cases?
So again, it's really hard to tell without concrete data, but in my position at Indiana Legal Services and the outreach that we do, I would say yes, it's definitely on the rise. And the reason I say this is in part because going back to the outreach work we do to migrant farm workers in the state of Indiana, the use of the guest worker visas that have typically been used for jobs that U.S. workers do not want to do, and that's agriculture, landscaping, certain types of hospitality, horse groomers. Those visas are increasing every year. And in, I want to say 2011, the number of H-2A seasonal agriculture or migrant agriculture worker visas that were issued was only a few hundred. And now in Indiana, we're regularly, 2,000 or 2,500 of those visas. We're in this state, we're seeing at least 4,000 to 5,000low wage temporary or seasonal workers come in from other countries. And that system really sets people up to be in a forced labor situation if they're being charged a recruitment fee or if they're coming to the United States with a debt before they even start working. The work that we are doing with sex workers and street workers, we have seen an absolute need for greater capacity to serve these folks. And when, COVID virus came to the United States and shut a lot of things down, it didn't mean that trafficking went away or that people weren't being exploited. It just drove it further underground.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about work being done to curb cases of human trafficking in Indiana. And if you'd like to get in on the discussion, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a short voicemail with your name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. And, Kristen, what I was wondering, you're talking about these guest visas that folks are able to come in on, and then they end up in these situations. Does immigration play a lot into the factor of people being taken advantage of? Are these people that are doing the human trafficking, that this is their business, so to speak, are they specifically targeting people that are coming over to the United States?
So the way that it works in agriculture and in construction is you have industries in the United States that need cheap labor. They don't want to pay, the industries can't afford to pay, significant benefits, and it's temporary. And it's something that U.S. workers don't typically want to do. There's usually a language barrier. So you have contractors. And the contractors have contacts outside of the United States for workers, or they'll go and recruit workers. And in the case of a lot of agriculture workers, these workers aren't being recruited from Veracruz and Mexico City. They're being recruited from really rural parts of the country, where the amount of money that a young single male can earn might be $20 to $50 a week. So if someone goes in and says, can you perform farm work, which doesn't require that much of a, experience, maybe zero experience, maybe up to 3 months of experience, would you like to come to the United States and perform this work? I can get you a job that'll get you a visa in the United States to work for maybe 10 months. And you could make maybe $15,000 to $20,000 on that visa. But look, what are you going to do for me if I get your name on that visa? Because all these middlemen, all these crew leaders want a cut of the pie. So they charge illegal recruitment fees, but it's a real investment for someone in a rural town in Central America or Mexico, because the idea that they're ever going to make that amount of money in a year is profoundly absurd. They might not make that much money in 10 years. So it's worth it for them to take out a loan or borrow money from family members to be able to come up here. And then the idea that they can come back every year to work for the same employer or for another makes it all the more difficult for them to report a violation because they want to be able to come back the following year. So there are people that are utilizing their language ability, their connection with other countries, and their ability to recruit workers in foreign places to bring them here. And they are really a major part of the problem.
Well, before we wrap up here, what are some of the solutions that our listeners can take to combat this problem?
So listeners should really understand that human trafficking is very subtle, and it is going on all over. And it really hits hard at specific communities, namely immigrants, undocumented immigrants particularly, and individuals who are isolated or who have been exploited as a youth. The issue that I would like community members to know, though, too, is that trafficking survivors have rights. They have a lot of rights. And we do a lot of outreach to help people know about their rights. But we represent trafficking survivors in suing their traffickers and getting their records expunged. And we have multilingual attorneys and social workers that are at ILS to help stabilize survivors, to get them housing, to help get them benefits. And we can really provide a comprehensive support system to folks who want to get out, who want to get help. And they should feel mm-hmm. like they're not alone. But we definitely need more resources at the state level because we can't just isolate the legal issues and not have emergency housing and transitional housing and adult case managers for adults and proper mental health support. It all works together.
Well, thank you so much, Kristen, for giving us all of that detailed information. So many different layers to this. I want to thank all of our guests for taking the time with us today. Shruti Rana with the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum and Kristen Hoffman with Indiana Legal Services. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brook. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for our show on March Madness. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In. We'll